Hey gang, this week's episode is brought to you by oldschoolshirts.com. Hey, check them out. You like defunct teams and leagues and t-shirt form? Well, you'll find them there, but a whole bunch of other stuff too. Do you remember a radio station of the past or perhaps a mall that you used to go to? All kinds of great cultural and sports memories can be found at the great folks at oldschoolshirts.com. Promo code GOODSEATS for 10% off all of your purchases. And now, here's our show.
Curtis, look at him snap these mares. This man weighs 235 pounds as he's flipping around here. And I think Bud's going to let Red come in and possibly have the honors of putting the great Bolo away. Bolo is in bad shape. They've been working him over for one. No, but he flail kicks out at two. Not quite pinned yet. Red up those ropes again. Whips Bolo around and comes topside. Let's see what he's going to try. His famous Gilligan twist. This is it. Bolo's shaking up. It's rocking and rolling to keep those shoulders up off the canvas. Trying to keep from being pinned. And while Red cannot quite get the pin going here. Red, I know, is he going to tag? He is, just as he falls out of his Gilligan twist. To let Bud Curtis come in and see what he can do. So Curtis is a wild man now. They've got Bolo in a bad way, and they're really going to try to soften him up. Because he's the big opposition. There's that face stomp. Look at that. One and two and three. And there it is, the first ball. Wild Red Berry and Bud Curtis take it as Bud Curtis pins the great Bolo, the team of the great Bolo and Louis Miller.
Welcome to Good Seats Still Available, a curious little podcast devoted to exploring what used to be in professional sports. Here's your host, Tim Hanlon.
Well, this is going to be interesting. I'm certain of that. Hi there, friends. It's your pal, Tim Hanlon, and it's Good Seats Still Available. Say it with me, will you? It's the curious little podcast that is devoted to what used to be in professional, underline professional sports. And the distinction there is important this week as we venture into a little side thing that we like to call, or most people like to call, or questionably call, professional, quote-unquote, wrestling. And a fascinating conversation awaits you this week with our guest, John Langmead, and his great new book. I learned a ton from this. It is called Ballyhoo, The Roughhousers, Con Artists, and Wild Men Who Invented Professional Wrestling. Yes, we're going to go into the origin story of professional wrestling. Kind of the, I guess I would say sort of the late 1800s until maybe the early to mid 1940s, where professional wrestling kind of got its roots sort of evolved into, I guess, what Wikipedia now calls a form of athletic theater. So is it quite professional sports? Maybe not so much. Is there athleticism involved? You betcha there is. Theatrics, undoubtedly. And I think it's a fun exploration as we sort of get into sort of the roots of how this thing called professional wrestling came about. I think a lot of people kind of just don't know, right? I mean, they think the WWE kind of just existed out of a whole cloth. Clearly, it was known as something known as the World Wrestling Federation, WWF, before the World Wildlife Fund decided that they wanted to own the copyright of those letters, and understandably so. But prior to that, there was a whole interesting set of stories as to sort of how all of this evolved. The sport of professional boxing very much had a role to play in the evolution of this. There was something called the National Wrestling Alliance, which, like the name implies, did its very best in the from the turn of the century, the turn of the 1900s, tried to sort of nationally associate this fledgling sport. And then it dissipated for a number of reasons, which we'll get into sort of a regional and or local kind of presence until folks like Vince McMahon and people around him prior and since have tried to kind of bring back together a more national kind of approach. And it's a multi-billion dollar industry, this professional wrestling thing, and not just the WWE, but it's a fascinating tale. It's a really interesting story. And that clip that sets the tone kind of is just sort of a snapshot in time. That goes to 1953, a little outside the zone of our conversation. But in 1953, this is kind of what you heard and saw on your television sets. That was a series called Championship Wrestling and featuring the dulcet tones of the announcer, Bill Welch, who you might have heard and seen on your television set. It might have been on the Dumont Network. It might have been on a syndicated, I think that was a syndicated show, that Championship Wrestling. But, you know, Championship Wrestling or professional wrestling goes back to the earliest days of television itself in the late 1940s as it was becoming a thing. It was one of the staples of the Dumont Network, for sure, and all the broadcast networks. And this Championship Wrestling series was very much part of that television firmament. You heard there Mr. Welch calling the first fall of the Great Bolo, also known as Al Lovelock, and Louis Miller taking on Wild Red Berry and Bud Curtis in a tag team match at the world famous, very much in quotes, Hollywood Legion Stadium, which is now the site, I believe, of a Pep Boys. So if you want to get your car lubed and ready to go, you can, while you wait, think about the various championship wrestling bouts that were occurring on that very site. That was recorded on August 31st, 1953. I'm not sure when it aired. It's probably shortly thereafter. And a really kind of fun little touch point there of professional wrestling circa 1953 and just part of the long and just crazy history of this thing called quote-unquote professional wrestling, the conversational topic this week with our guest John Langmead. Again, the book is called Ballyhoo, and it is subtitled, again, The Roughhousers, Con Artists, and Wild Men Who Invented Professional Wrestling. It is out now. It came out in January. It is published by the University of Missouri Press. Highly recommended reading. And you think you know everything about professional wrestling today? Well, understand the origin story with this book and this conversation. You can find a copy of it just if you'd like to go to your independent bookseller just down your street there. By all means, go do that and have them order it for you. Of course, you can go to our website at goodseatsstillavailable.com. Just search up this episode number 341 with our new pal John Langmead, and you will find a convenient link to this book, and you can get it in a Kindle or hardcover version. That'll be courtesy through the auspices of Amazon, our referral friend that we get a couple of pennies and nickels of referral love. We appreciate it when you purchase any and all books or forms of media through those links there found on our website. Either way, get yourself a copy and curl up and enjoy this story that we're going to highlight for you now and hopefully titillate you with and encourage you to get that book. Here's our conversation we had with John a number of weeks back, just roughly when the book was coming out in January. We're sorry to have delayed it until now, but please, as always, enjoy. Give me a sense of who you are, what your sort of professional life is, and what's your adjunct and or interest in sort of telling the origin story of this thing called professional wrestling, he says.
I can tell you. So I got interested in professional wrestling as a kid. I was probably 8 or 9 years old. I feel like I can kind of, I always forget the exact dates, but I can sort of trace it to like an exact sort of moment, but I was watching on television and I had seen wrestling before, but there was a match that just really caught my attention. And I can't explain why it did, but for some reason it did. And it just, I was completely hooked, and I got really into the professional wrestling magazines, which is like a whole other story. But basically, they were like wrestling themselves. They were sort of made up. You know what I mean?
First of all, I'm curious as to what era we're talking about. But second, yeah, I guess those magazines, okay. I guess you can call them pulpy, if you will, literally and figuratively.
Pulpy, for sure. It's sort of like if you can imagine a kind of fabricated Sports Illustrated that presented, but certainly not presented that way. I mean, it was presented completely straight-faced. And I, as a kid, I loved it. So yeah, this would have been, I was born in 1975, so this was about 1984. And this was when professional wrestling was just exploding, right? Vince McMahon had sort of had just taken over for all intents and purposes from his father, and he was starting the World Wrestling Federation and really going national with it across the country and putting out a business. It was sort of the last gasp of what they call the territories of these sort of really mom and pop kind of promoters that worked in these local states and counties and putting on wrestling, right? And it was like a local thing. And, you know, McMahon sort of ended all that. But, yeah, and we lived in Baltimore, so we were able to see wrestling from all over the country, because we would get it from Dallas and from Charlotte and from Minneapolis, because Baltimore was one of the towns that promoters really fought over, and it didn't have its own promotion. So lots of other promoters fought for sort of the Baltimore audience at the time. So it was a fun time to be a wrestling fan. It was obviously the beginning of, like, people all know Hulk Hogan and they know things like that. It was really the beginning of that when he went national and became a national figure.
Yeah, I think you're describing kind of a business model that McMahon kind of perfected, which is essentially, like a lot of industries, a consolidation from sort of these very regional, very local kinds of propositions, and trying to sort of streamline them and then obviously aggregate them. And then this television thing, right? So that's also very interesting. And I know we're going to get sort of really in the pre-television era with the bulk of this conversation, but I think it's especially relevant because here we are recording this about a week after the WWE just signed a gigantic deal with Netflix, which is, you know, Netflix's first sort of live scheduled event programming. Some would call it its toe dip into the world of sports. And, you know, it continues to be a phenomenon that drives television viewing for a bunch of different reasons. But you're talking about a period of time in the 80s, right, where, you know, I say prior to, you know, that this was the advent of cable, and a little bit prior to that, you really were talking about syndicated television, you know, the beginnings of what was then known as WWF. Would be syndicated shows, half hours, hour-long shows. They would be syndicated to various television stations across the country. And, yeah, I mean, I'm slightly older than you are, but I remember some of those early events, too. And when you're of a certain, shall we say, impressionable age, it's hard not to think that this stuff is real. And did that guy get hurt with that chair being slain on his head? Or what? I mean, this is crazy. How could this be going on? And they went to a commercial. How could that be, right? But it's kind of hard not to get sort of all wrapped up into it.
It is hard not to get wrapped up into it. And this is a conversation. I could honestly have this conversation with you for hours and hours on end. I'm doing, and this is getting off topic because a lot of this isn't, none of this, that the era we're talking about is really post what I was writing about. But the other thing you have that's happening around that time that was just fascinating is obviously Andy Kaufman was getting involved, and that was when David Letterman happened. This was all just a little bit pre the Vince McMahon era. But it's so interesting to me because all that stuff you're talking about, he really pushed the boundaries of all that. But I have a kind of feeling of, like, I think what attracts children to it, I think sometimes, is in some respects, it's like even they can see through it, right? Like, in some respects, you're like, clearly he didn't hit the guy on the head with the chair, right? Like, you kind of have a sense, like, it can't be. Like, that would have really hurt, right? Like, kids can kind of see it, I think, in some respects. It's a bit like comic books, like, you kind of get that it's a fantasy world, but it feels kind of very real to you in the same respect. So I think that's part of its appeal, is it's just like these things happen and you see them with your own eyes, but yet you also kind of know these can't be real. Like, it's too fantastical. And I think that's part of the enduring appeal of it. And I think what my interest in really writing this book was really, first of all, how seriously, right? Some people get, usually at the time, people would get so upset about it. Like, how is this wrestling's fake? And how can you think this is real and all this stuff? And, but just this idea that it exists at all is just absolutely, to me, absolutely wild and fascinating. And I think the word with Vince McMahon, again, to go back to that, and what they did was really homogenization too, of you really erased what at the time was these, again, like just local TV shows, right? They would film at the local like news station, right? Or like the local TV station. There'd be like 50 people in the audience when you watch some of these, you know, smaller promotions. And it was just amazing. I've heard them by some people described as like almost like a playland, like a fantasy world where you could go. And you would just see things you can't see in the real world, but yet it's happening in front of your very eyes. It was so unique. It's such a unique thing to me. And like I said, and it's like you said earlier, no one had, in my mind at least, had really quite written the book of like, where did this thing even come from? Like, how is it that this even exists? And that was really what I was kind of had set out to do.
So a couple of things to unpack there, and then we will dial back to the period of time here that you're focused on with this really excellent book, Ballyhoo. The aura, I guess, or the mystique of that sort of localized kind of thing. This is, you know, arguably pre or very early television, or at least very locally centric television kind of thing. I mean, you could make the argument, as I think a number of professional aficionados have, is that, you know, by sort of nationalizing and amalgamating all this kind of stuff under this World Now Wrestling Enterprises umbrella, you kind of squeezed out some of that mystique, right? Because you could squint hard and maybe kind of see a little bit, or maybe you were going to these local events and stuff, and you really didn't sort of see or have, you know, national exposure for all this kind of stuff, and it felt more real, so to speak, to your point. I find that fascinating. And here's one little quick little piece of trivia for the seven people who listen to this show on a regular basis. I was actually at the taping of that David Letterman show with Andy Kaufman, with Jerry Lawler.
That's amazing.
Totally amazing. And I will tell you, and I think this applies here. I will tell you, everybody in that audience thought for sure that was a real slap and it was completely unscripted, including yours truly. What people did not see during that that episode in, what was it, 82 maybe, I think, was a whole bunch of consternation in between the, you know, when the commercial break happened, and Kaufman threw coffee at Lawler, and Letterman was, I don't know if Letterman was in on it. I think he was in on a certain
He wasn't, level. By all accounts. Yeah, by all accounts, he was not at all in on it. Happy, from my understanding.
Yeah, and probably for, but I will tell you, they literally stopped the taping, which was like verboten back in the day when they were doing that kind of stuff. So, but it speaks to the theater, right, of all of that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Andy Kaufman stuff I can talk about all day, but I mean, I think what's interesting to me about that is it's so illustrative to me of that, what we're kind of talking about in that era of, I think those, And this is, I think, carries through in the era I'm writing about, too, which for people who are kind of just picking this up is, you know, I kind of focused on the early 1900s, so like up to about the 1940s. But really the idea, I think, behind the book is that the conventions are really kind of all set by that time. Wrestling in 1930 really didn't look that much different than wrestling, I would even say, in like 1992, like really up to kind of pretty close to modern day. The Andy Kaufman thing, I think what's illustrative about that and what ties it back to the people in the book I'm writing about is this idea that you carry it forward. Like they didn't do, even if people were to question them, right? It's this idea that they had to support the narrative that obviously all this was on the level, right? Because if you get, again, even if people could see through it, and I think people did have a sense, it's certainly there were elements that were prearranged, but it was certainly felt real enough that they could get wrapped up in it. And that was what people were looking for, was just to get kind of carried away by it. You know, the same way we get carried away by, you know, a professional football game or whatever, people can get carried away by a wrestling match. The idea, though, is I think if you put it in the time, certainly if you had put it in their face and the guys had said, well, no, this obviously this is real, or obviously, you know, this didn't, whatever, that would have kind of burst the bubble a little bit. And the thing with Andy Kaufman is if you watch the video of him from around that time, if you ever go down that rabbit hole, I mean, he was going on talk shows. He went on Saturday Night Live. He had his neck brace on. He went on, it was amazing to me, he went on the Merv Griffin show, co-hosted, at the time it was guest hosted by Orson Welles, the episode he was on, wearing his neck brace, in full, essentially, character, saying, yeah, you know, he's like, I got dropped on my head. For people who don't know, during the match with Jerry Lawler, he was dropped on his head and injured his, you know, said he injured his neck, in front of Orson Welles. And if you can kind of just imagine how mind-bending that must have been for him to do that with a straight face, I can't even conceive of it.
Well, the fact that this exists and was so established even by that time as sort of an understood sort of premise, I think really just underlines how important sort of this period that you outline in this book sort of really was for this, right? And look, at the end of the day, wrestling, you know, freestyle or regular sort of actual amateur wrestling, you know, is and was a thing, but it turned into some kind of, I don't know, I guess you could say it evolved into a more of a performance art kind of approach. And I think that's why this period of time that we're going to discuss now kind of really is so foundationally important, because it didn't sort of come out of thin air, like, because this is a fun thing to do. Maybe a little bit of background, because I'm curious as to some of the roots. And it feels to me, both in your reading and some of the extra research I've done, that there was like a legitimate sort of wrestling circuit out there in the United States, in particular, in the, you know, late 19th century or so. And it kind of evolved out of something genuine and true sport.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that was one of the things I was interested in, too, is how does this thing, right, how does something that's, Stuart, it's certainly rooted in reality and true competition and true what we would think of as sport, you know, evolve into this kind of other thing. And like what you said with performance art, I would agree with that. I would also, I personally would call it sport. You know, I don't have a problem with that. I'm sure there's plenty of people that do. But yeah, no, I mean, in the early days of really, I guess what we would think of as what became professional wrestling, a lot of it was, people are certainly familiar with like the carnival wrestlers, right? That would go around in circuses and carnivals and challenge people in the audience. But even before then, you had guys who would travel around challenging, right, each other. And some of your listeners might be familiar with like what they call rough and tumble fighting, right? Like just back in the old days when people would just fight, right? Like in a field, like after the, and it really got popularized like during the Civil War, people that were trading techniques around different styles of wrestling. So like what we think of as like Greco-Roman amateur wrestling, things like collar and elbow wrestling, what they called catch-as-catch-can wrestling, all those different styles were kind of evolving at the time. And they all were effectively different rules about how you might be able to grab onto the person, or you know, how you started the match, whether you started on the ground or from a standing position, things like that. I try to touch on that in the book. I didn't want it to be necessarily too in depth on that time, because my interest was certainly more, I think, to your point of how it evolved into kind of a show. But I don't think you can talk about that without talking about the real roots of it. But again, these guys would travel around the country challenging, you know, other of the local butcher, the local blacksmith that was maybe the wrestling champion of their town, who was just effectively just the best wrestler in that area. And they, you know, wrestle in a field somewhere or something for people who were betting. And then sometimes maybe if they thought they could really draw a crowd, they'd hold it at a local theater and charge, you know, some kind of admission for people to get in. And it was all about this idea of getting people to kind of pay to see something happen. Right. And I think as other sport, and wrestling obviously predates all that, because you don't need equipment. It can happen just between two people, all that kind of stuff. But as other sports came along, I think it was wrestling and the people behind it really were realizing it was going to be a struggle to make this thing work as a professional attraction, because frankly, it was just kind of too boring for most people, especially compared to something like boxing. So I think they were finding ways, the performers, you know, in the early days, it was the performers who were kind of working between each other to make the match exciting, right? And like figuring out how to keep people in suspense. Eventually that fell to the promoters, who were kind of dictating it to the performers of, you know, how long they were going to wrestle, how the ending should be, things like that. So the, how that happened and how it happened so quickly, was just, again, something I was really interested in and wanted to explore.
Well, so it's interesting you mentioned boxing, because that's clearly also a tributary to the sort of the origins of this, right? Because, you know, around that time, again, late 19th century, you know, boxing was certainly becoming a, if not, you know, firmly entrenched sporting spectacle. I mean, it was truly an athletic contest between generally two gentlemen. And, you know, I guess by comparison, right, sort of the, shall we call it, pure sport of wrestling was maybe a little less attractive and maybe a little harder, I don't know, to follow or sort of see action, so to speak, from a fan's perspective.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, and I talk about this a bit in the book, you know, boxing, you sort of, you can get it, right? Like, if you've never seen a boxing match, if you just turn one on, you get it, right? Like, before it kind of, it's about punching the other person until they kind of get knocked to the mat. Wrestling is a little more complicated, and especially, you know, in this era we're talking about, 1880s, 1890s, a lot of the, you know, the grappling would happen on the ground, you know, and the objective was really to turn your opponent over onto their back. So a lot of, like, that maneuvering and the drama that took place between the two people was happening in very close quarters. That was not always really readily apparent to the audience what was going on. And people would sit, I mean, these wrestling matches would go on 4 or 5 hours sometimes, right? They would go until like 2, 3 in the morning, if you can imagine, which is impossible to me to imagine, but it's true. People would go but they found ways to make them, you know, very, very dramatic for the audiences that were there. And you can't really talk about wrestling without talking about the early days of boxing as well. And that's something I covered in the book, especially because the main character, a promoter named Jack Curley, might be familiar to some people because he had a hand in the Jack Johnson, but really he was responsible for the 1915 heavyweight fight between Jack Johnson and Jess Willard, and was worked pretty closely with Jack Johnson during his reign as heavyweight champion. But it was a pretty porous relationship because a lot of wrestlers boxed and a lot of boxers wrestled in the very, very, very early days. And boxing was illegal, too, in a lot of states, were heavily, heavily regulated, so whereas wrestling wasn't. So I think that enabled wrestling to get more of a foothold because if you wanted to go out and see, you know, two people beat each other up, wrestling might have been your only option, really, back then. As boxing got more firmly established on legal grounds, wrestling really was in trouble then because you could have, you know, you started getting guys like Jack Dempsey and things like that, where huge names, and the boxing just became much, much more popular and much more accessible to people.
All right, well, let's talk about this Jack Curley, because he obviously plays a major role in this narrative. That you wrote, and I guess he's almost the confluence of both of these tributaries, right? This he essentially kind of has sort of early rumblings of a career around boxing and promoting and that kind of stuff, a little bit of journalism and sports writing and that kind of stuff as well. But then wrestling was part of his work set as well. And maybe a little bit of background about him and maybe sort of how he evolves, perhaps, into sort of more focused on what would become professional wrestling.
Yeah, absolutely. So Jack Curley was born, for as far as we know and as far as he always claimed, he was born in San Francisco in 1876 and got interested in boxing at an early age, ran away from home and took part in the Chicago World's Fair. And from there, really got into the kind of more underground scene in Chicago, and got hooked up with boxing promoters that were running boxing shows in the city. He he took to traveling around. He worked with some guys that went on to, one of the guys that went on to win the World Heavyweight Championship at one point, and was a really influential boxing promoter in the very early years of the 1900s. By about the late 1910s or so, early 1920s, he was really being elbowed out by, and most people will know this name, but by Tex Rickard, or Rickard, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but who ended up being really the preeminent boxing promoter in the country, really, and in history, probably. And so Curly was really, I left without a lot of options. And I think that wrestling, while it might not have been his first love, I think he came to love it. And I think he came to realize he had a real opportunity there to have an active promotional career. And I do think he loved putting on shows for people. I think he loved entertaining people because you see throughout his career, he dabbles in promotes Rudolph Valentino at one point on a nationwide tour. He promotes the Vatican Children's Choir. He promotes the Castles, who were a kind of dancing phenomenon back in the late 1910s. So I think that all of that exposure to show business and all of that exposure to celebrity, I think, played into his conception of what professional wrestling could be. And at the time, I mean, it's really hard to overstate, I think, how well known he was. I mean, he was covered extensively in newspapers. He was written about extensively. He eventually gets into handling the career of Bill Tilden, who was the most famous tennis player probably in the world at one point when Bill Tilden went professional in about 1930. He worked with Jack Curley on his national tour. But again, he always had this association with professional wrestling and was responsible, though I think his role largely, he was seen maybe as like the kingpin, and then he maybe had this kind of ability to just, you know, dictate winners and losers across the country. But really what I think he did was help organize what otherwise would have been these localized promoters. And his goal was really to, like what Vince McMahon eventually did, create a national wrestling organization. And I think he really wanted it to be taken seriously as a sport. I think he did love it, but I think he was absolutely integral to making it much, much more of a performance.
Yeah, it's interesting. Certainly under the tutelage of a Tex Rickard, at least for a period of time, right? Tex, I mean, we've talked about this on previous episodes, right? I mean, this is the guy who Rickard was the, you know, he's a foundational in one of the early versions of Madison Square Garden. He founded what is now the New York Rangers in the hockey realm. Obviously, a big boxing promoter and that kind of stuff. But you can get a sense, right? I mean, the Bill Tilden thing with Curly, there was a thing going on, right? There was a sports promoter hustle going on as the century turned, where, you know, there was money to be made and spectacles to be put together and promoted, right, for entertainment, right? And these guys were pretty much at the forefront of that around that time.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it's that whole kind of barnstorming idea. I mean, you see it in all the sports. I mean, you know, baseball had sort of its barnstorming element. Football had its barnstorming element. Really, people that would, you know, teams or individuals who would travel around the country just putting on shows for people, right? And different displays like of athleticism. And I think what's so cool about that era and what I enjoyed writing about it so much is just how unformed it was, right? And like, especially now when sports is practically, God, I don't really even quite know what to call it. I hate to call it like a religion, but I mean, it's sort of like probably dominates more of the attention of people in this country than almost anything else, right? Like, to think of an era when that just was, not when it just wasn't the case, but when sports was just really in its infancy, professional sports. And how, again, how much of a role, like you said, these seat-of-your-pants promoters played in getting it all off the ground. And again, I think that was what the difference between Rickard and Jack Curley was. To your point, like, Rickard was really willing to bet the farm on things. You know, I think he was really willing to bet it all. You know, he pulls off the Jack Dempsey Carpentier fight and draws like 80,000 people to that. But I mean, that was a real seat of your pants last minute kind of promotion thing that could have fallen apart at any time. Jack Curley was a little more, I think, conservative, and also, I think, considerably less skilled pulling off the spectacles. Rickard was, really made an art form out of it, for sure.
So, all right, so give us a sense of how Curly sort of more forcefully gravitates towards wrestling over boxing. And maybe, is there, I don't know, an event or some kind of revelation along the way where Curly just sees that this could be something of great significance? Because there's a period of time where wrestling, I don't want to say out of the blue, but kind of gets a certain level of appeal right up there, maybe even in some cases even more interesting and appealing to the average sports fan than boxing itself, albeit maybe not necessarily always as exciting as it could be.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And what's interesting about that, too, is that wrestling it kind of outpaces boxing's popularity in weirdly different times. Like, it's kind of cyclical. Like, the two really have kind of this kind of interwoven relationship where, you know, in the eras where boxing was extraordinarily popular, wrestling's popularity really suffered. And then the vice versa was true. So I think that you first see that, and Curly really first starts getting involved in professional wrestling right at about 1908, 1909. He gets involved with a guy named Frank Gotch, who some people might be familiar with. Definitely the most famous professional wrestler of the era. And you could probably say, pound for pound, one of the most popular professional wrestlers of all time. I mean, and really in the 1909, 1910, he was maybe the most famous athlete in the country. I mean, and so he was an early professional wrestler, won what was considered the wrestling's heavyweight championship in 1908 from a Russian wrestler. And he really established, I think, America as a force in professional wrestling. Now, again, you can look at that era and you might be able to say, a lot of people question, right, how much of this was real at the time, how much of it wasn't real, were these matches on the level? And there's, you know, we're obviously never going to know. I think everybody has differing opinions on that to some degree. But so Frank Gotch becomes the most famous wrestler in the country. And in 1911, Curly works with him to promote effectively a rematch with a guy named George Hackenschmidt, who was probably Europe's most famous wrestler at the time. They get together at Comiskey Park. They have a match. I mean, 32,000, some number of people come out for that match, if you can imagine, right? I mean, yeah,
it was an attendance record that stood, I think, through baseball and all the sports and stuff, I think, until the early 1940s in Comiskey.
That's right. I think you're right. I mean, and that's for a professional wrestler.
Late 30s.
Yeah, and so Curly stages this match at Comiskey Park. It has a pretty unsatisfactory outcome for people. Gotch wins, but it's a pretty disappointing match for reasons that I go into. I won't necessarily go into them here. But my feeling on it is that I think what happened a little bit is I think they realized the sport was almost too precarious to allow it to kind of be in the hands of the wrestlers themselves. So I think that the promoters, guys like Curly and some other guys, some of the other managers at the time, start taking a much stronger hand. And by about 1916, 1917, a really amazing kind of phenomenon happens where you get a quartet of wrestlers who are all very big names, and they're traveling the country effectively matched up with each other. They're in some ways like trading the heavyweight championship, right, between each other. Like one guy would lose, you know, to another in Omaha one night. And then a couple weeks later, that guy might lose to another member of the group, you know, down in, you know, Chicago, something like that. And they're making headlines all around the way and drawing sellout crowds. And this all really culminates in a match in 1920 that Curly promoted at Madison Square Garden between two guys, Joe Stecker and a guy named Earl Caddick, who were two of the most famous wrestlers at the time. And they sell out Madison Square Garden. It's like 20-some thousand people or whatever it is that shows up at that. From there, wrestling really, again, kind of hits the rocks and goes into decline for a number of reasons, but one of the biggest being, I think, really kind of the rise of boxing and Jack Dempsey and Tex Rickard, as well as you know, some kind of questions around whether it's legitimate or not. And it kind of struggles and has its ups and downs really until the 1930s when it kind of explodes again.
All right, what's this? OldSchoolShirts.com. Fantastic. You've heard me talk on and on and on about the great folks and the great wares at OldSchoolShirts.com. Like the name implies, it's old school and it's shirts, and they put them together, see, into what they call OldSchoolShirts.com. It's like the name implies, but of course, we love them primarily for their sportswear. You name the league of the past, you name the team of the past, the chances are huge that they're going to have more than one shirt and different color schemes for things that you may remember from the United Football League or the Major Indoor Soccer League or various flavors of the original XFLs, plural, or the Federal League, perhaps, or maybe World Team Tennis, or maybe it was the North American Soccer League, and on and on and on. But hey, it's not just sports. It's also great cultural touchstones and memories from the past. How about the officially licensed Evel Knievel connection? Connection? How about collection? Yeah, that's what he's trying to say. Various colleges. How about dead malls of the past? Ice cream parlors, maybe even radio stations that you might remember. Hey, even there's a latest edition of the old, now old, Aloha Stadium commemorative shirt. All that kind of stuff and more. You will find at least a handful of shirts that you will just transport you back into your past, and you will amaze and impress your friends at the same time. It's oldschoolshirts.com. And we got a promo code for you, of course. Let's save you some dough while you go there. And it's promo code is Good Seats. Good Seats. That's the promo code at oldschoolshirts.com. Promo code Good Seats for 10% off all of your purchases. Hey, P.F. Wilson and your friends at oldschoolshirts.com, thank you for your sponsorship of the show. And now, back to our conversation. So, all right. So the inklings, the hint of potential below board kind of approaches and stuff, it clearly sort of dates back, you know, to some of these early years. I guess what I'm curious about, and neither of us were there, but I'm trying to get a better sense of what fans were expecting as wrestling sort of gained its toehold. Because you're mentioning earlier that not all these sort of wrestling bouts were necessarily fun to watch. They could be long and laborious. And you said it before, you know, maybe the wrestlers themselves couldn't be trusted, especially if they were trying to truly wrestle their way to a victory. I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, and I'd love to hear your thought on it, is where is this the beginning of the fusion between the sport and or the entertainment component of this? And are there any telltales? Are there any situations? Are there any how does that sort of evolve? I know it's probably complicated.
Yeah, no, it's a great I think a crucial question. I think approach it in the book, and I think most of the people I talk to probably will agree with this, but I mean, I think the two were really, and this isn't just in professional wrestling, right? I think this is in every sport in some ways, if you look at it, right? They're all, they're sport, but they're effectively entertainment in some ways too, right? Like, if you have, you know, there's a big difference between, like, you know, the game that was just the Ravens and the Chiefs, like the level of drama in a game like that, or even the 49ers-Lions game. And if it had been 42-0, right, people would have been tuning out, you know, by the middle of the third quarter. So there's an element of entertainment certainly in every sport and wanting to keep people hooked on sort of the drama. I think the thing with professional wrestling is in some ways it's maybe a little easier to manufacture that. And I think that the wrestlers, I think they understood that pretty early on. I think that I write about a match. I want to say it happened in around 1874 in San Francisco, a pretty famous match now. They got a lot of play in newspapers around here between two guys, one named Theobald, the avowed Balor and another named William Miller, who put on a series of matches around San Francisco. I think they very, very clearly understood the benefits of putting on a show for people. And I think that you see that carry on throughout. Balor was a pretty famous wrestler that he kind of gets supplanted at a certain point by a guy named William Muldoon, who some people, if you follow sports, you know, from the 1910s or 20s, Muldoon was a very popular figure. He went on to run the New York State Athletic Commission. But there's no doubt that he understood the value of putting on a show for people, and that if you didn't put on a show, if a match ended too quickly, if a match took too long, if a match was too one-sided, you know, you might draw a crowd once, you might draw them twice, but you're not going to draw them the third time you come to town. So I think the difference, though, is over time, showmen, and I write about this some in the book too, is that showmen took on a more prominent role. I think there's a difference between two extraordinarily capable wrestlers putting on a show for an audience, and, you know, one extraordinarily capable wrestler and one person who really has no background whatsoever, trying to put on a show. And I think that, that's why I don't ever hesitate to call it a sport, is because I think anytime you've got in the ring somebody who's kind of a dangerous grappler, and I try to really kind of write about, you know, what some of those guys were capable of doing. I think anytime you've got someone like that, there's always that sort of strange X factor of, like, you don't really know what they're capable of, right? You don't know if they're really going to fit to the script. You know, maybe they'll change their minds. And I think, as you see, really, and I try to write about in the book, there were plenty of instances where that happened. And I think that calls into question, again, what does it mean to be fake? If there's sort of this uncertainty that runs through it all, what does that really mean?
Right.
You know, that was something that absolutely fascinated me.
Right. There could be improvisation, right? And I guess to me, it almost feels like a collision between the idea of that being able to improv, but within certain, maybe agreed upon ahead of time boundaries, right? But and choreography, right? How do you the balance between choreography and improv, right? Is arguably that could make for great tension, great variety of outcomes, but arguably could, at least from a promoter's perspective, maybe at least have a loose set of rules where one could, you know, time out what a, you know, an evening of entertainment might look like, how many bouts to schedule, that kind of stuff, because there's some kind of agreed upon, you know, logistics or rules, shall we say, not even rules.
Yeah. Oh, I agree completely. And I mean, and I think too, that's what helped wrestling in the early days of television. I mean, professional wrestling has been a staple of television.
It was one of the first things on live television when DuPont Network was turning on.
If it wasn't the very first thing, it was, you know, number two or three. But no, I mean, literally since television's been a thing, professional wrestling has been being showed on television. And there were a lot of reasons for that. One of them was partially what you just said, is that if you have a 60-minute program, you know, you can kind of time it, you know, and you schedule five matches, you can make sure those matches wrap up by the time you hit that 60-minute. Or if you want to build drama, maybe you make sure one doesn't end, so people tune back in next week to watch to see what happens next, kind of thing.
Well, what of, though, in these sort of this early iteration of wrestling and its transformation, what role did gambling have to play, right? Because clearly, boxing was a very popularly, illegally bet sport. Gambling was, you know, certainly out and in the wild, so to speak. But it seems to me that some of the above board, I guess, or at least intended to be above board wrestling matches, would have a higher propensity to sort of go too long or kind of go to a no contest or a draw. Unlike, say, boxing, where there was arguably a bit more of a determinant factor as to who won or lost. Is that a theory there, or is that, am I just blowing smoke?
No. I mean, I think gambling was a huge part of early professional wrestling, just like it was for every sport. When it exactly stopped being that is a little bit unclear to me, but I think so. In the match we were talking about, the 1911 match with Frank Gotch and George Hackenschmidt, one of the things that I think really upset the audience at that time is before the match took place, and again, for reasons I go into the book, they effectively called off all bets. The chief of police from Chicago gets in the ring and declares all bets null and void, because, and that effectively tells the audience, they're like, this match is going to be a sham at this point. But people were absolutely betting on professional wrestling matches. And what's kind of interesting is, I think that there was also an element of collusion sometimes with the wrestlers, because I think because wrestling was so easy to for the two performers to sort of collaborate on what they were doing, and like you said, kind of have a predetermined, or as they go, they could feel the match out. So as betting would change throughout the course of the evening, or as one person became more of a favorite or not a favorite, or the betting kind of tipped in one person's favor or another, in some respects, they could get signals from certain people planted in the audience as to which way the match should go so that they're going to make the most money. And I think that was definitely going on. Boxing, there's some interesting stuff. Part of the reason that was so difficult to do that with, there's some early sports, right? Although it certainly went on. But even at the highest profile matches, you know, there's people who talk about it's kind of impossible to fake a knockout. It's sort of impossible to fake, you know, a human body effectively being punched into unconsciousness. The body just has a way of kind of reacting in a way that you can't quite fake when you're talking about something in a knockout. But wrestling's a little different. You know, somebody getting turned over to their back, somebody getting pinned, somebody being kind of put in a hold that maybe knocks them unconscious. That's a little bit easier to stage for people. I think by the time you get the World Series with the Chicago, the White Sox throwing the World Series, things like that, wrestling had really kind of fallen out of favor as something people would gamble on. And I think as they realized clearly it was kind of morphing into a show, betting was just kind of just not something they were going to bother putting their money on with boxing. I will quickly say in the beginning, and I what you said really struck me, this idea that everything old is new again. I mean, I couldn't get away from the fact as I was writing this, like, and all of the problems that were created with gambling in the, you know, turn of the century, to think like, my God, we're going right back to sports gambling. And it was definitely on my mind as I was writing the book that, again, like you said, everything old is new again.
Well, Curley, though, is credited with kind of, I guess I'm trying to come up with some kind of parallel. I was like cricket, reducing, right, the potentially elongated sort of match that maybe doesn't go anywhere to sort of this sort of one stop, what do you call it, one fall,
right.
Shorter kind of, which is, I guess, if you will, almost like an artificial time construct to essentially make stuff a little bit more quick, peppier, and maybe arguably could bring more matches into a card.
Oh, yeah, you're 100% right about that. And I think that I don't go into too much in the book, but one thing you do see that other historians on wrestling have kind of pulled out is, and there's an era around, again, with this 1917, around that time when they were really, I think, kind of writing kind of in stone, I think, the things that, would kind of be held as sort of tenets, of basic tenets of a wrestling match, right? Again, this idea, by 1917, I think the matches looked a heck of a lot like they look in 1987, 1997, right? They were really figuring out how to build drama. I think, to your point, I think part of that did come from the fact that they realized people really hated it when they would spend their money and spend, you know, an entire evening to watch a match and it just ends in a draw. And now you might have a draw. There's a famous example too in the book of a match. It was in 1916. I forget exactly, but it dragged out for over 5 hours between two wrestlers, right? And by the end, people are throwing their seat cushions and throwing garbage in the ring and things like that, but they refused to leave because they wanted to see who was going to win the match. And so I think they figured that out, that audiences really hated to take their night and then not get kind of a satisfactory finish. So I think you're right, is that they did find out that these draws were absolutely driving people insane. And especially if you have two evenly matched wrestlers, I mean, they can kind of circle each other for an hour. They can kind of not really engage for an hour if they, you know, things like that. There's ways that they can kind of draw and elongate a match. the promoters, I think, effectively tried to put an end to that. By 1920, and as you're getting later into that era, again, matches are getting a little shorter. They're getting way more packed full of, like, drama. And then by the 1930s, you have a guy named Jim Londis, who some people might have heard of, and he's really the, I think, the height and the culmination of all of that, where his matches were just really electrifying for people.
So I'm really curious. So a lot of this, the heartland, or the heartbeat, the locus, I guess, for a lot of this activity around the evolution of this sport / performance art is the Northeast and the Midwest. And I think you sort of mentioned it earlier, right? There was a lot of barnstorming, and I'm guessing also sort of like carnival-like kind of things, right? You sort of waft in and out of sort of the, I mean, there were guys out there making a living, you know, trying to, you know, take on all comers, so to speak, and getting comfortable with the idea of how to, I don't know, make marks out of the audience who felt that they could, you know, show their girlfriend that they could take on a quote-unquote professional wrestler in a period of time. And in a carnival environment, that doesn't necessarily go all that well. But it's probably skill building if you're going to get into this gig.
I think that's absolutely right. So I think the carnival wrestlers, I think there's some debate about when the traveling circus has become more of a thing, but I get the sense it's in the early 1900s, it starts being more of a, you get these people that are traveling around the country as you know, the wrestler in the carnival, right? And it's exactly like you said, they would have a tent, they would you'd get into this thing where they're sort of boasting to the audience, you know, they can't be beat, or they're the greatest wrestler in the world and nobody can take them on. And that was really largely to get someone from the audience to be willing to kind of put some money on the table that they could go in and either, you know, maybe last 10 minutes or if they can beat the wrestler, you know, win even more money. And sometimes, like you said, they would kind of juice the betting there by having a plant in the audience get up and come into the ring with them and go the full distance, right? This is somebody they knew, right? Somebody they were working with in the audience to make it look like they were beatable. And then that would sort of, you know, encourage the locals even more to, you know, put some money on the fact that they could get up there and win. And of course they never did, because these carnival wrestlers, I mean, were quite and could be quite dangerous. You know, there's one wrestler who shows up in the book. I think he's killed, they say at least, he killed at least two people, you know, probably accidentally with some holds. There's these, so they called them hookers, you know, they could exploit pressure points and things like that on a people's body. They could wrap you up into these really kind of dangerous holds. So you didn't really want to mess too much with those. But the reason partially they did it, first of all, is if they lost, they were out of a job. And secondly, you know, if you got in the ring with somebody who was really kind of an unexpected local, somebody who might bite, somebody who might throw elbows at you, kind of more dangerous things like that, you had to really be able to handle yourself. So I think they could certainly make money. I think it was probably a very exciting lifestyle. But I think some of those guys, they wanted to get more into the professional ranks because it was probably a bit more staple and a little safer on their bodies in the long run, I bet.
All right, two major questions I have sort of to kind of round out a little bit, because we're going to leave this at the doorstep, fortunately or unfortunately, around sort of the beginning of television and sort of the next sort of generation of all this. But the two sort of major questions in my head are kind of number one, when does this sort of the populace, whether that's sports writers, whether that's fans, whether that's other promoters, maybe the sport of boxing, when does sort of the, I don't know, a real sort of a drumbeat of questioning around the legitimacy of these matches really start to kind of spill out into the public, right? How much of it was sort of under people's breaths and undercover, so to speak? And when is there a period of time that maybe you identify where the real questioning kind of started to evolve and a real challenge to the legitimacy of these matches was starting to kind of spill out into the open?
God, yeah, no, it's a really great question. I mean, I certainly think there were, and as I kind of show in the book too, I think there were always questions. There were undoubtedly always questions. And I think it was that way in a lot of sports. I mean, and you would certainly know, you know, more extensively than I would, but certainly you see the same thing in boxing. People were questioning, you know, every heavyweight championship fight, you know, that happened. You know, Jim Jeffries said, you know, when he lost to Jack Johnson in Nevada, you know, he said he was drugged, you know, and then you get really every heavyweight champion really who had before Jeffries that had some kind of excuse as to why they lost, right, their title. Jack Johnson said Jack Curley paid him to lose his title, right, when he lost to Jess Willard. So I think you see that a lot. I think there were a lot of questions at the time, even of whether gamblers had kind of put their fingers on the scale, even in baseball and all kinds of sports, right? It wasn't just wrestling. So I think wrestling existed in that kind of weird stew that I think we kind of almost can't even imagine nowadays, right? Like, we can't imagine that professional sports would have been so openly questioned as crooked in a lot of cases, because that doesn't really happen too much. And if it did, people probably may not follow them quite as extensively. So when wrestling, I think wrestling was probably questioned on about the same level. I think that by the early 1930s, when it goes through its real golden age with guys like Jim Landis leading the way, guys like Gus Sonnenberg, they were still questioning it, but I also think that it was such an entertaining show. I think that they approached it from that respect, that they were respectful of it. I think they really, and I think that's the key thing, is I think they really respected the wrestlers as athletes, even if they did recognize that sometimes what they were doing was a bit more performance than true sport. I think there was always the possibility it could be sport. I think they recognized that, you know, obviously they couldn't control the outcome. There was always, again, this kind of X factor that, what if their opponent went off script, right? Like, I think that was always an element running through it. And at the same time, you had guys like Strangler Lewis, who was an incredibly popular wrestler, but there was no question that he was a great wrestler, right? Even if he was engaging in a bit of a show, there's just no doubt that he was a great wrestler and a dangerous guy, right? So I think that the sports writers treated it with, even if they had fun at its expense, I think they respected it. I think they really respected the wrestlers for the most part. So they would never really go up and ask Jim Landis, you know, was that match a fake, right? What's he going to say, first of all? Like, of course he's not going to admit anything. So I think they played along to a certain degree and they had fun with it. I think that something really happens towards the end by the 1940s. I think, and I write about this in the book, but there's a national trial that takes place in 1936, where these wrestling promoters sue a wrestler for effectively going off script during a heavyweight championship match. I think the whole business became so ridiculous, and so the promoter's greed became kind of so apparent to everyone that the sports writers just stopped writing about it altogether, especially in the major cities. In some of the smaller, like you said, Midwestern and Southern cities, wrestling was still covered to some degree, you know, in newspapers and things like that. But in the major cities, you didn't really have it written too much about unless something really extravagant happened. But again, I think up until really about 1936 or so, it was a major staple of sports sections across the country.
Yeah, and there's no doubt. I mean, the physical dexterity and just the prowess and the athletic skill, frankly, that's necessary to even do the choreography, if you will, right, it's almost like being a master, you know, ballerina or professional dancer or any other sort of professional, you know, endeavor where, you know, the body is forced to do all kinds of contortions and muscle memory kinds of things and stuff. And I think that's even makes it harder, or probably at least in the earlier days made it harder to discern what was real and what was not. And arguably that probably played right into the hands of promoters like Curley and others who kind of didn't mind the curiosity and the questioning and the, I don't know, maybe it is. I don't know. I don't think so, but you know,
I think Jack Curley definitely embraced that. I think that they understood the kind of appeal of this, is it or isn't it, kind of what that held for fans. And again, I think fans were pretty well aware that, you know, the whole shebang wasn't really on the level, but I think they enjoyed that. I think that was fun I think it was a lot of fun for people. I really think that. And I think that the other thing you see in those matches is that there wasn't a lot of stuff like people weren't jumping off the top rope. There wasn't, you know, these things that they kind of call sort of show holds, things that you might really on its face be like, there's just no way you could do that. You know, Jim Landis would do an airplane spin where he would put people up on his shoulders and spin around. And then, you know, that was his finishing hold. That was about as close as you got to kind of something that people could kind of really see through it in some respects. Right? Like, that can't be, you know, real, but it looks awesome. You know what I mean? But I think it was just believable enough that, again, I think they could really enjoy it and get wrapped up in it and have a convincing night of incredibly entertaining sport, you know, or something that comes pretty darn close to looking like a sport.
All right, well, here's my last question, and then I'll let you promote. I wonder where you sort of see, what do you think came first in this evolutionary period? Do you think the melodrama and the spectacle and then the face versus the heel kind of thing and the feuds and did you think that sort of emanated first as the sport was evolving and maybe trying to just differentiate itself or maybe even separate itself from what boxing was and that kind of stuff? Or do you think that only came after it was, if you will, discovered that there was some untowardness, shall we say, towards the legitimacy of the bouts and, you know, it was found out, so to speak, and it had to be sort of embellished to kind of survive?
Yeah, God, that's such a great question. I mean, I think that you're seeing some of that consciously crafted. I mean, as early as like 1908, 1909, there's a guy I write about in there named Leo Pardello, you know, who would go, and I want to say this was around 1909, would go and have these like bloody matches, basically. Guys would go and they would keep capsules of blood in their mouth, you know, and it would basically look like he was beating his opponent to death in the ring, you know, and there was things where some of the audience members called the police, right, because they thought they were actually witnessing like a murder in the ring. And he fully realized, there's no doubt he realized that people would pay money to come and boo him. And so I think that they figured that out relatively early. I think that in some respects, sports writers put that on them too. Like, I think that where there wasn't necessarily a lot of maybe inherent drama, they created it. So even in things like, can you see this with like the Jack Johnson fights, right? Like things like the Great White Hope and you know, talking about Tex Rickard, you know, when he promoted the Jeffries Johnson fight, there was all kind of stuff there around, you know, the sort of battle between the races and things like that. So the sports writers really put that on there. And I think that Rickard really ran with that. I think somebody said this to me and it was just, it stuck with me. I mean, this was maybe 10 years ago or so, but this was during, and I hate to keep bringing up the NFL, but it's obviously, it's hard to escape.
It's not too many steps from maybe what we're talking about this hour. Yeah.
Well, yeah, you know, and I think that if you look, I think people are very quick to, I don't know what quite the word is. It's not dismiss, but they're willing to kind of just really just kind of think, oh, that wrestling, ugh, you know what I mean? And kind of just put it to the side, less so nowadays, because now I think everybody realizes it's show and all that stuff. But if you think back really to before that, but so many of the elements that I think wrestling fans love about professional wrestling have been adopted by other sports. Either consciously or unconsciously in some ways. Somebody said this to me once and it just really struck with me. And this was during when Peyton Manning, or maybe it was Tom Brady. He was just having this incredible run and this drama about, oh my God, you know, he went to the Buccaneers from the Patriots and he won the Super Bowl. And there was just all this drama around him and Belichick and all this stuff. And it's like, if the NFL could manufacture that every year, they would, right? Because people are really drawn to that. They love that element of sort of drama in sports. It has nothing to do with the game. It's all the sort of superstructure that goes above the game. But in wrestling, you can manufacture that. And what's wrong with that, right? And I think it really, it adds that extra level of excitement for people, that level. And I hate to say storytelling, but it's just the added narrative that goes around the actual competition itself. And that is so present in other sports. And it's not always that, right? If the athletes don't produce it, the sports writers are going to produce it, the announcers are going to produce it. And I just don't see that it's necessarily all that different than some of the stuff that goes on in professional wrestling.
Well, it again, everything old is new again. I mean, that brings us right back to the Netflix deal with WWE from a week ago as we record this, right? And you know, Netflix arguably was or is or has been credited with taking a Formula One right to the next level because of the belief in creating narratives in a documentary type of style or form, right, that introduced these drivers to a whole new audience, a younger audience who may not have been racing fans whatsoever. And now you see every league and team and athlete now, you know, falling over themselves, trying to create bless, if you will, a documentary or some kind of narrative building to kind of fill in or introduce people to the sport and the stories behind it versus, you know, the mere, if you will, pure competition that you might see during the live event. And maybe we just described how to maybe the sport of wrestling has kind of really perfected it. Arguably, some others are trying to figure out how to do just the same.
That's right. I think that's right. I think that you're right. That human element of it. Obviously, the other thing that professional wrestling brings to the table that others don't embrace quite so much is. And again, this is, and I write about this. This was clear in the early 1930s. They were doing this. Things like class tension, right? Like they would be like wrestlers who flaunted how much money they had, who flaunted how much better they were than everyone in the audience. Things like that. Wrestling plays with that stuff, obviously way more than a lot of other sports can get away with, but it's endlessly fascinating. Again, ways to get people in the audience to sort of dislike you and knowing that they're going to pay money to come. Didn't it all full circle back to Andy Kaufman? I mean, that was really his shtick when he got into wrestling, was insulting people and making them hate him, right? And like having them, I think he did it a little too well, but I mean that, has been a part of wrestling for over, you know, 100 years.
Well, I love this book. This filled in a big sort of gap in my knowledge. And I don't consider myself a wrestling aficionado. I'm aware of it. I certainly respect it on a certain level for what it is. Nobody can doubt the spectacle of it and the narratives and just the big business that it is and stuff. But I think it's fascinating to frankly recognize. I mean, I think there are a lot of people of even a couple of generations, right? They sort of, we talked about it before, right? I mean, in the 1930s, early 1940s, when television was essentially in its infancy, there were very few things that were really out there, the live event kind of thing. There was news. There was an occasional baseball game or two. There certainly was boxing. Sometimes there was a little bit of bowling, and there was absolutely wrestling. I mean, I'm talking like all four. I mean, the Dumont Network and the two ABC, the two NBCs, right, and all that stuff, right? I mean, right. And the fact that it was so, call it fully formed, but the fact that it was such a ready-made television kind of spectacle already, right? That doesn't happen without what we just discussed in the decades prior. And that, to me, is just fascinating. I think people just automatically think it was just an invented spectacle when the television was invented, and that's clearly not the case.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think that people who, like, to go all the way back to the beginning, but people who got into wrestling in their 80s, in the 1980s, I mean, the people who might be in their, like, late 40s, early 50s now, they probably think Vince McMahon, and I hate to keep bringing him up, obviously, because of the recent news and some of the revelations, but, you know, they may think he invented professional wrestling. And, you know, clearly, I'm sure he'd be happy for people to think that. But, you know, that definitely wasn't the case. Even if you look back in 1946, 47 with, you know, when Gorgeous George was on television and was a national phenomenon, you know, but again, he was borrowing from people that had been around for 20, 30 years before him to build that character. The kind of ingredients had been forming for a long time by the time it hit television and became a national sensation for a long time. And it never left. I mean, wrestling had been on television. Once it got on television in the late kind of 1930s, it stayed there in one form or another until, you know, like you said, the Netflix deal, and it's going to keep being there. And again, my interest was really in where the heck did this thing come from, right? Because it feels like it's always been there, right, in some weird ways, but we just have never explored too much who was behind it. What is all this stuff? Who were the guys that kind of invented this, and what were they like? And that was really my interest, was trying to kind of get inside their heads to the degree I could and get inside their lives as much as I could to kind of talk a little bit about what it was like at that era.
We'll be right back. Okay, I must confess that I am not a professional wrestling kind of guy, but I learned a ton and am fascinated by this origin story because it was part of the traditional professional sports landscape in the late 1800s, early 1900s. The diversions that it took to separate from, say, where boxing went, to me is really, really intriguing stuff. And you must run, not walk, to get a copy of this book to understand this more in detail. It's great. It's fun read. It's called Ballyhoo, The Roughhousers, Con Artists, and Wild Men Who Invented Professional Wrestling. It's by our guest this week, John Langmead, and you can find it wherever good books are found. It's published by the University of Missouri Press. And if you'd like to go pick up a copy at your local independent bookseller, by all means do so, or get it ordered from that source, by all means. But of course, if you want it most conveniently and like to give us a shekel or two of referral love, by all means, please go to our website at goodseatsstillavailable.com. Search up this episode with John, numbered 341, and you will find a couple of convenient links to this book. And you can get it from Amazon in hardcover or Kindle version. And we appreciate you doing so through that path, if you choose to. If you are interested in the deeper story of the life and career of Jack Curley, the boxing promoter who kind of took things to the next level, those Madison Square Garden events in the late 19-teens and the early 1920s, if you know of or were intrigued by names like the Strangler, Ed Lewis, or Frank Gotch, or Gorgeous George Wagner, or Dynamite Gus Sonnenberg. There are many of those stories and tales and personalities and more to be found in the book Ballyhoo. Highly, highly recommended. If you'd like to follow John on social media as he continues to promote this book and or otherwise in his sports and other endeavors, you can find him on Twitter/X at John_Langmead. That's at John, J-O-N underscore Langmead, L-A-N-G-M-E-A-D. And what else? While you're on social media, why don't you follow us? We're at Good Seats Still on X/Twitter. You'll find us on Instagram at Good Seats Still Available. Also the same handle, Good Seats Still Available on Threads, as well as on Instagram. Did I just say that? Well, whatever. And on Facebook at Good Seats Still Available as well. So thanks for that. If like to send us some email, you can do that. We're at hello@goodseatsstillavailable.com. Let's see. What else? Hey, Jerry Payne, you know who you are. So does our audience by now, if you've been listening more than one episode. He's the guy who makes this sound somewhat logical and puts up with us each week with all of our various editorial parts. Thank you, kind sir, for doing it again for us this week. Thanks for listening, of course, to all of you. Thanks for those proverbial cards and letters and your emails and all that kind of stuff. We appreciate it. More fun and frivolity headed your way next week. Until then, please stay safe and happy spring, everybody.